And welcome to Extraordinary Brains. We've got hecklers from outside of our well-apportioned studio, which is definitely not just the back room in our house. I'm Max.
And I'm Tess, not Max.
And we're speedrunning the intro because Tess needs to, first of all, eat her breakfast, and second of all, go and do her GCSE revision for her GCSEs that start
Tomorrow.
So please, everyone, send love and vibes to Tess for her GCSEs.
Send me vibes.
Yeah.
And money.
And money, yeah, not money. That's, anyway. So today's episode is with Professor Amanda Kirby. It was a really great chat a week ago. You can probably still remember it.
Yes.
Amanda is a trained GP, fantastic champion of neurodiversity. Anyway, the episode, because we did quite a lot of explanation during the episode, it pretty much speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fun.
Yep.
So enjoy it, and we'll see you.
Oh, by the way, don't actually send me money. That was a joke. Please do not send me money.
Right.
Okay, enjoy the episode.
Bye. So, welcome to a new episode. We are joined by Professor Amanda Kirby. So, I'm going to read out your Twitter bio. CEO of Do It Solutions, which we'll have to talk about. Parent and grandma of a wonderful neurodiverse family. Oddball, educator, medic, author, tech entrepreneur, researcher, DCD, ND campaigner. So, lots to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even mention what you're professor of. but maybe we...
I can tell you about it if you want to. Yeah.
Oh, I'm just a professor. It's no biggie.
It's only a part of who I am, really.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to sort of reach out, because you have so much diversity of an interesting and diversity and a diversity of interest. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little.
Very true.
There's a tag for you. But welcome, Amanda. You're someone I've obviously followed on Twitter, and I think we have kind of Venn diagram of overlapping professional interests and professional relationships with other people. But it's a first chance to really sit down and chat, so I'm very excited. Tess, how are you?
Very, very tired.
Yes, Tess is... long-time listeners will know that Tess is often tired at the beginning of episodes, so shall we crack on?
However, in this case, I think I probably will still be tired at the end of the episode, but keep an eye out. Plus, listen to the end to find out if I'm still tired.
We were out quite late last night.
Yeah, maybe you'll be a little less tired, but that's fine. And I'm tired too, Tess, so I'll join in with your tiredness.
Right. Okay?
So, Amanda, if you don't mind, we'll crack on with our first question from Tess.
So, thinking about when you were growing up, when did you become aware of being different and how did that feel?
I think I always felt different. I just remember an experience in school. I'd made this sort of craft thing. I used to make stuff, right? And I made this pottery, tiny little plate of different food and things, which was, it was quite quirky. And I took it to school. I was really proud of it. And I'd painted it and done stuff. And I took it to school and my friends just laughed and dismissed. And I remember that, I remember that feeling of, well, I thought that was great, but they think it's stupid, moment. Mm-hmm. So I always felt at the edges in class often. So I'd be very friendly and I'd have some friends, but I would never quite be in that group that other girls were in, and didn't feel totally a part of that group.
Mm.
And in class, I was really helpful. And I only think now that was a coping mechanism, but I didn't really think about it at the time. So I would always be the first to get up and to do things and to offer to take things. But it was my way of getting out of situations or not having to have long, boring conversations with people that I didn't want to have boring conversations with. So I felt different. I've always felt different, but I recognize my differences are similar to other people today, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's very wholesome and conclusive.
Well, I just think I recognize other people have felt the same. And growing up, I didn't always feel like that. Do you know what I mean? I had some really good friends, and often my friends I chose or chose me were older. I often had friends who were a few years older than me. But even then, I remember them. I remember going to something, and they all knew the words to the. They were listening to records because that was the day when we used to have records, and we were listening to records, and they knew all the artists, and they could name the music straight away. And I've never been able to do that. Never. My auditory memory is rubbish. I know what I like, but I couldn't remember who the artists were unless it was sort of Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, or Cat Stevens. You know, there were like three things that I sort of recognized. Oh, yes, I knew, you know.
Yeah. But
both things that you have in a box upstairs on LP.
Do I?
Yeah, Tess does. Tess has inherited her mother's vinyl collection.
And some of my grandmother's.
And some of your grandmother's as well. Mm. So, yeah, they're both of those. Well, Cat Stevens, the Teeth of Tillerman, is up there. Yeah. Anyway, so, but, which is a wonderful album. So interestingly, I think it sounds like a little bit of a sort of subtle, not exclusion, but a subtle difference and a moving away from the mainstream, but that didn't seem like, it doesn't sound like from what you're saying, it particularly impaired you or made you feel, gave you any sort of mental health difficulties or did it?
Yeah, it did. So I was highly anxious, really came from quite a high performing family where there was an expectation, I think, for me to do well. And my dad was a doctor and wanted me to be a doctor. That's what he wanted to be. And I sort of wanted to be a psychologist. But I went to medical school and I became a doctor. I'm very happy that I am a doctor. But I was desperately frightened of failure, so much so that I would make myself ill in exams. I would be so anxious that I couldn't sleep, and then I would do badly in exams, and I would freeze and I couldn't perform, and then I would just would be that cycle that would just go round and round, which would then go, well, there you go, I can't do exams, you know, and then I'd be more fearful. And in my late teens, I certainly had an eating disorder. So late teens, early 20s, I had an eating disorder. So it certainly, anxiety certainly impacted, was a huge part, you know, of what was going on and thinking about my identity and where I fitted in. I had some really great friends, you know, and I've still got them. So some of those friends I've had for all my life, life, really brilliant friends. But I didn't fit in with the groups. I never felt like I was in the group, whatever that group was.
And I think such a common thing of neurodivergent people is that it's not that they can't relate, perhaps even on a one-to-one basis, is that they can't fit in with the broader social expectations. And that thing about remembering artists when you're sitting around listening to a record is a tiny little thing, but it's actually sort of significant. It just marks you as that little bit different and a little bit excluded. Do you think that your family, you know, so your parents or whoever was around, realized your difference? Did they appreciate it? Did they want it to go away? What was the response, if there was one?
I think they sort of accepted that I was really anxious. I don't think they realized that it's a compensatory, how much I compensated. So, you know, because of my focusing, I would drift, you know. I've just been writing about exams, and it's made me think about my list, and I'm still a list of a list person, you know. But it was a way of sort of controlling what I was trying to do, was create a list that I would know. I don't think they appreciated the sort of the bounds that I went to compensate that were hidden from a lot of other people. Mm. So it was very much internalized. It was very much, I didn't really talk. I don't think I knew, because that was my reality. So my reality was I had to work really hard, and it was really pissy because I'd worked really hard. And the girl next to me, who was, I think, was equally as bright as me, did much better than me, right?
Yeah.
And I knew the answers. But getting it down on paper in a sort of coherent way, wouldn't do so well in written exams.
Yeah.
Because it was time stamped and it was time pressured, and it wasn't the way that I was really good. It was like at medical school, as an undergraduate writing the exams, I had to work extraordinarily hard, and I got married halfway through and I had a baby.
Oh, right.
Well, so
halfway through medical school when.
Yeah, I was a medical student, had a baby, married, got a baby, ridiculous stuff. But But I had to work extraordinarily hard, you know, and I think that was often hidden. So it was getting up really in the morning and it was working much harder. And it was only when I got to be a doctor and I was on the wards and I was with patients, I loved that.
Yeah.
I like people. I do right. like people, right? And I like listening to stories, and that was what that was about. And so I found that much more, it was much easier for me than reading books.
And you went on, you sort of, tell us a little bit about your medical career and how your diversity, I mean, did that impact on your medical career? Do you think it changed where you chose to go in terms of your, you know, your career choices?
I think that and motherhood probably changed my career choices. I loved, I actually quite liked surgery, ear, nose and throat surgery, because I liked the surgeons who were nice people. So they seemed to be nice with kids, but they had that sort of technical skills. But
I think people are often really nice. I don't exactly know what it is, but you're right.
I know that.
Yeah. Yeah, so they were.
Yeah, Tess has not had that experience.
I've not.
Sorry, there's a little bit of medical chat here, Tess. I apologise.
It's okay.
So I needed to work part-time. So I was the first person in the UK to do GP training part-time.
Right.
And I applied for that before I qualified because I had to plan. Because
you already had a child, yeah.
Because I already had a child. And so I did that over 6.5 years as opposed to 3 years, and then had a couple more children on the way. So I had to become really organised, you know, even though it wasn't my natural state to be organised. Yeah. I had to do it for survival because, you know, so I had to almost become super organised. I've heard that from other people who sort of become super organized to control the situation, to know what's going to happen. Otherwise, you can't manage that situation, you know. So I think that happened. And then I had a child who, my second child, was diagnosed with dyspraxia, or developmental coordination disorder, when he was 3. So I had to be organized. I had to sort of sort that stuff out. So that was difficult, I think, but you didn't have a choice.
No,
so, you do that? Well, like, you don't have a choice.
Yeah. And I suppose it brings us on to our second question, because very often the diagnosis of a child starts to a process of understanding in the rest of the family, including the parent, of their own difference, and vice versa sometimes, Tess.
Yep.
We were having a nice conversation yesterday with Tess's grandfather about her great-grandmother's ADHD traits, his own ADHD traits, my diagnosis, your diagnosis, and your brother's.
Both.
Yeah, that sounds like our family.
Everyone's got traits. It comes with the surname. But that does bring us to our second question for you, Amanda. So, Tess.
It does. So, what was your process towards understanding your difference?
I think it was exactly what you just said, which was gaining a diagnosis of my child and the journey that I went on. He changed my life. I mean, he's, you know, in so many ways, because I was a GP and I'd been working in doing community peds and sort of new stuff around developmental disorders. All of a sudden, somebody was saying to you, oh, yeah, he's got dyspraxia or developmental coordination disorder. Then he had other diagnoses as well after that, including ADHD. But it started me on a whole journey of this is, first of all, we were going from places to places and telling his story again and again. And that was really frustrating because I thought this is an experience that lots of other people had. But actually, ironically, the next 25 years, probably, till relatively recently, I hadn't looked at myself properly either. Mm. So I looked brilliant at looking at everybody else around me, my family members, my brothers, sisters, you know, everybody in my family, my father, you know, we've got on both sides of my family, my husband as well, we've got a really neurodivergent family, right? So we've got ADHD and autism and dyslexia and developmental language disorder labels, right? We've got lots and lots of them all over the place. And that did make me think, but it's only been probably in the last few years that I sort of stopped and went, right, I understand myself, because I think it was that big thing about girls. I wasn't thinking about girls and ADHD, right? Because what I had been looking through this whole time was boys and ADHD, and I didn't fit that. So where did I fit in? I knew I felt different, but I didn't fit anywhere because I haven't got dyspraxia. I haven't got dyslexia. I've got lots of ADHD traits. Now I know what they look like, but it really was very much later. So I got to know the rest of my family and, you know, and plotted that out over the last few years.
Do you think, just before I sort of dive into your understanding of specifically your diversity, do you think that to an extent, you said it's to do with, you know, being a woman and not fitting into that kind of stereotype of male ADHD, but is it also because of your roles as a mother and as a doctor, you know, and subsequently as a grandmother, and, you know, is there a sort of, I feel that this with women, and speaking as the only man on the call, you know, that there's a societal expectation that you look after other people first and that you don't think about yourself, particularly in those roles that you had.
Sorry, I've just completely cut you off. But I think that a lot of the stuff people say where it's like, oh, women this, women that, they're not talking about like assigned female at birth people. They're talking about people who have been raised with the expectations and with the teachings that women have been like biological, that people who were born as a woman have been raised with.
Yes.
Absolutely. So I agree with you.
That's the reason why like girls with ADHD, girls with autism are, like, tend to be way better at masking because they have been raised to show that their issues are not the most important. They should, you know, I mean, boys get, like, people who have been raised as boys get this as well, but it's on different scales is what I'm trying to say.
No, I think it is.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. So I was raised, my mum was a homemaker. My dad went out to work, and we were feeders. So in our family, lots of cooking, lots of people around, lots of meals, and tend and befriend, right? So a lot of that mode. So it was always being helpful. And that was my upbringing. My brothers, I look back and I go, oh my goodness. But my brothers would sit at the table and I would get up and clear, right? At the end of a meal, right? And you think now, my children, I would be, first of all, that couldn't possibly happen, right?
But who cleared at the end of meals at our house, Tess?
Well, I clear up more often than they do, I'll say that.
But that was the state of play. That was expected. So you're so right that I don't think it's only now that I've had time to reflect. You know, it's only now at this stage in my life that really over the last year or so that I've been able to really reflect on me growing up, the things I'm telling you now, and see how they fit into a picture.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have been able to do that. That's, you know, so, and it is because I think you're absolutely right. I camouflaged so much, and I'm very good at going into a social situation. I've learnt, you know, brilliant social scripts, you know, that I can do that. I can do that well, but I don't feel comfortable. It's effortful, you know? And actually, as I get older, I'm thinking, shit, I don't want to do that stuff. You know, if I don't need to, you know, I don't have to do that. And that was the thing. I had to do that. I had to be organized. I had to have social expectations that were meeting others.
Yeah. And it's just an additional drain on your batteries, on your sort of mental and social batteries that you're constantly having to draw on as a neurodiverse person. I suppose, and it's sort of starting to connect in with our third question.
I was just about to say that.
You ask the question and then I'll do some follow-ups.
How do you feel about your difference now?
I'm celebrating it. I really am. And that's the wonderful thing that I see now, where we are now, that we can have these conversations. And I think I'm at an age where I can say what I feel and I don't have to worry about it. So that's a freedom that I've got to at the age and stage I'm at as well. I've also got neurodivergent grandchildren who I'm hoping, you know, that, and I see my son who's grown up and he's a wonderful person and the person he is today. And I think that we've got right to celebrate, you know, and to have these conversations that are sometimes really difficult. And that's why I think I want to be honest, you know, because I think in the past I would have never said I've had eating disorders.
No.
You know, I would never have said that. I would never have said I've been so anxious I couldn't go, you know, to into an exam. I wouldn't have been able to say that stuff because I think I've hidden so much of that in the past. And I think now I can go, that was part of me, you know, who I am is warts and all. And I think that's really important. But there's some great stuff going on there as well, you know. So utilize the things that I can do and I like doing and I'm able to do, you know, and I can shove out the things that I can't do.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, it is, I think, potentially inspiring if you're somebody who's struggling at that stage in your life with anxiety and mental health problems, to have somebody who's then, you know, who is a professor, who is, you know, who's achieved what you've achieved, who's come from where they were, you know, that, and that's not to do with, and that's not to say, well, if you don't become a professor, then you're a failure, but that you can have a fulfilling, you know, an interesting life coming from that point.
I think there was something, and I don't know, I think if I look back, what changed my view about me were some people who believed in me along the way. That made such a difference. I've got probably three people in my life who were fundamental to going, that's a really good idea. Not that plate with my bits of food, which some people thought was really odd, but my quirky idea, because was okay and really good. And they believed in that. And when I first set up an interdisciplinary centre nearly 30 years ago, and I'd go and do talks for health professionals, and I'd be looked at like, you know, challenged, and it was a really uncomfortable thing. And it's not been easy, but I had people, key people at points in my life that actually said, go for it.
And who were those people?
So I had, I was working in general practice, and there was a guy who was he was running a healthcare company, and he said to me, and I ended up as communications director. I've had an eclectic career.
All right.
And he said to me, what do you really want to do? And I went, well, what I really want to do is set up an interdisciplinary centre. Da, da, da. And he went, go for it. I'll fund it. So he funded it for me. Yeah. So
what was the centre for? What was the
for children with developmental difficulties, disorders? Okay, and it was a transdisciplinary centre, and it was 25 plus years ago. So we started with a blank sheet of paper, and it was because of being an experience of a parent telling stories again and again. I thought, this is no good. And this is the same challenge today, you know. And we started, we tried to integrate that together. So parents and the children, the child was listened at the heart of the consultation. It wasn't in the room being talked about. We did a lot of stuff that I felt was really important, you know, and providing practical strategies. You didn't need to wait 3 years to have something about tying shoelaces to go to see somebody professional for that.
Yes,
you could
exactly.
Do that on day one, right? So he was one. Second was Professor David Sugden, who's died sadly now. Well, the second one was Bonnie Kaplan in Canada, who's a great woman who's a psychologist and worked in paediatrics, who again looked at all people as a whole. One is the first people who are doing a lot of the work on co-occurrence and how all of these boxes aren't boxes,
yeah.
And how they overlap. And mm-hmm. She believed in me. And I found her, I listened to her and I understood her. And then the third person, I think, was David Sugden in Leeds, who was an educator, worked in the field of dyspraxia, but really thought about, again, dynamic systems and thinking about people in their ecology of their life. So all of those people were allowing that conversation to happen. So you need to understand the person in the context of their life and not shoehorn people into boxes.
So I think it's probably a good moment to talk about your work. And has that foundation, the team that you built up, has that now become the sort of Do It organisation? Could you just describe to us what that does and what that is and what your philosophy is?
So Do It came from the evolution really of the Discovery Centre. So the Discovery Centre ran, and it was in the university we moved into the university eventually. And then that drove I wanted to prove I could be an academic. Maybe that's an interesting anecdote in a sense, is that I went to a conference and I had to give a poster, and I'd never given a poster and I didn't know what a poster was. So this is this quirky moment. So I thought a poster was pretty with things hanging off it, and I didn't really Right, so mine had things, and it was great.
Spoiler: academic posters are not pretty with things.
I know, they're really
incredibly dull things.
Well, now I know. So I'd arrived at this rather pompous academic conference. My poster had all things, and I felt really that difference, right? And I remember going to the dinner, the academic dinner, and we were put at the end of the table, right at the very end of the table, you know. Yeah. And I asked questions in the conference because I thought that's what I could do. I just asked, and everybody was going like, who is she? Why is she asking questions? And I remember it so much. I thought, I'm going to join your club.
Yeah. Right?
And that drove me to get my PhD and published papers because I wanted to show that I could.
Yeah.
That I could be part of that because I felt really different. Right, so that was a difference moment. It really was, that stuck with me so much. So the Discovery Centre was the sort of transdisciplinary centre, and we set up and we did research and we ran a clinic and we provided training. And then I wanted to do something which said, okay, how do we meet more people? Well, I was seeing one patient who was coming from all over the place and then another one. And I thought, well, there's lots of people out there who can't afford it, can't have access to it. And actually, why do we have to wait 3 years, 5 years to get a diagnosis, which then you get a ticket and you still don't get help with your exams or your planning or your organization. You just got a ticket which says, yes, you are the things you've just told me you are.
Yes, exactly.
About yourself. So I felt that sort of exchange system wasn't very good, really. So started developing a computer-based screening system, which is person-centered. So it goes that theme coming through, understanding the individual in the background of their life, and then generates practical guidance for that person. So we have Profiler, which is in schools, for universities, for colleges, in prisons, in apprenticeships, into employment. And then the guidance is contextually driven to those different settings, and even more contextually driven in some settings. accessible.
So effectively,
getting information out has continued, and we deliver training as well.
Kind of go to the profiler, put in some information about yourself, and it will give you practical advice.
Yeah.
That's essentially how it works.
Yeah, it's accessible, so it's spoken, it can be translated. It's got multiple modules, so it depends whether you are in studying, it'll have study skills modules. If you're preparing for work, it's got preparation for work modules. Then it generates guidance in different formats as well, so which is accessible. Little information, more information, visual information, sound information, so to suit different people.
Wow, okay. And people... And that is something that people pay for. That's sort of
organizations. People can buy it individually, but organizations buy it.
Yes.
So that it's open to everybody. Yeah. And then it sits on a management platform. So I'm interested still with my sort of, I became a researcher even because of that. So the data helps us to, so we're just looking at, we're in 24 prisons, for instance, in the UK, where people are screened. And helped and supported with practical stuff. But the information is guiding us to understand that people who got to prison who've got neurodiverse profiles and strengths and great stuff often haven't been supported. And we've shown from that work that people who have been excluded from school end up in prison and commit crime 5 years earlier.
Yeah.
Right? So the data's useful for helping us to understand how we can help and change things in the future as well.
I mean, the prison population is such a fascinating one because the level of neurodiversity in that population is just shocking and astonishing.
It is, but what we found is that, these single boxes that we look at people where we're saying, are you ADHD or not? Are you dyslexic or not? Are artificial constructs in a way, because we've all got multiple colour balls in our buckets. You know, we don't all fit into nice, neat boxes. And what we're seeing is people in the justice settings have often had other things going on. So I said, I've had some really good mentors through my life.
Yeah.
Often we're seeing high rates of homelessness, high rates of being in care, high rates of being excluded from education. So the negative, those things drive you not to get help and support.
Exactly.
So those are the other factors. So that's what we're finding, what we know. But it, in a way, what we want to do is go upstream and help and identify and support people earlier rather than waiting for that inevitability to happen.
And the implication of what you're saying is that actually as important as helping them with the particular difficulties is just connecting them with other people, to connecting these young people, keeping them engaged in education, keeping them engaged socially in families, connecting them with people who believe in them. That seems to me to be as important as identifying and treating their ADHD or whatever, by what you're saying.
Yeah, one good person can change your life. One good person who believes in you and says you are, and genuinely believes, not going, you're so clever, because that doesn't really help. But one good person says, you can do what you want to do. And my, interesting, my kids have done, nobody's a doctor in my family. So that tradition has ended in this generation. But they've gone and done what they want to do. And I think that's what, but they've had somebody who's people who've supported them. And I just think that's what we have to do. We have to support, they have to hold on to people, hold on to kids and say, let's talk about what you can do. Let's find ways of exploring what you can do and not go, you've got bad behaviour.
How do you think we're getting on with that in the current school system, Tessie?
I don't know. I think options are becoming way more open, especially when it comes to like gender stuff like that. But I mean, I don't know. Because I don't really know what it was like before.
No, that's true.
So but, I, mean, I can't really compare it.
Do you feel that people who in the current school system who perhaps are a little bit different, who don't achieve in a conventional way, are encouraged to be the best at what they are best at? Do you see what
I
mean?
Like Amanda says, it's dependent on the people. So it's the students' teachers,
yeah,
their parents. Because it's not, as a society, it's not a societal thing that we're not telling kids, because it's all dependent on the people directly surrounding them.
Well, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So it's quite
right.
hard. That's another reason it's quite hard to compare, because it's so individual.
Mm.
It is. It is, and I think that's the challenge, you know, is that we want to run education for everybody and do it, be inclusive, but actually it's everybody's got a different story to tell, you know, and everybody's yeah. experiences are unique to them, and it's their family setting, and it's the school, and as you say, it's that teacher, you know, a teacher can kill you off or encourage you, you know. I remember in school being told, you're useless at physics by a teacher. And then I gave up physics, right? And I thought I could never do physics. One line can change your life, and having one person connecting with you can change it too.
But you'd be, you know, if you were a physicist, you'd be a great loss to neurodiversity. So there you go.
I don't think I'd be a great physicist. I still don't think I'd be probably a good physicist, even though I could do probably GCSE physics now. But, you know, I don't think it's the career I'd choose either.
No. I mean, more power to people who do, though.
Absolutely. Incredible.
Mum doesn't understand the basic forces of motion.
No, your mother doesn't really believe in physics. Sorry.
Oh, you're right.
Ah, I just had a cough for about 6 weeks.
Okay,
and
cool.
Lots and lots of negative COVID tests. A lot of what we've been saying has sort of been circling around the question of diagnosis. So it's fascinating that your profiler doesn't deal in diagnostic terms. You have diagnosis within your family.
It sort of does but doesn't, because people are working within constructs that exist, and I'm a pragmatist, right? That golden tickets still get services, as much as I don't want, and there are biases in the services that people get. So, you know, the autism ticket gets you most at the moment, ADHD gets you far less.
Mm.
So not that I bias the responses accordingly, but so the underpinning of the questions I'm asking are framed around characteristics that we associate with ADHD, we associate with dyslexia, but the picture we generate is one of a whole, right?
Yeah.
We look across neurocognitive framing and capture information about background and what's going on and what might be happening as well. So I'm a pragmatist because, you know, with ADHD, One of my granddaughters got ADHD, and medication has made a huge difference. Huge difference, right? He read 15 books in the summer, you know, when he went from not reading much at all to be able to focus and read, and it's made an enormous change to him, right? So he couldn't have that without a diagnosis. So yeah. I recognize that we have to understand the diagnosis should be about that person, but the other stuff around them as well is important to know as well. And as a doctor, you have to do a differential diagnosis as well. You have to go, what else is it and what else could it be? Yeah. And that's one of the things in the kids we've been screening in children who've been excluded from school. We're just doing a big study, and 50% of them have had head injuries. Nobody's asked that question before, right? So it's as much as important to diagnose, it's important to say what else is going on as well.
It's what the context is. So just to go back, so the profiler doesn't produce a diagnosis, but perhaps it tells you what kind of
traits
you have. Yeah, so it uses that traits term, which is actually really helpful because from a school perspective, for instance, at least gives them, oh, okay, it's this sort of thing that we're dealing with. And actually, a lot of what is helpful is actually just knowing which ballpark you're in.
Yeah. If you get a diagnosis of dyslexia, what does that tell the teacher? Nothing, right? It says you're likely to have some reading, spelling, writing difficulties, of which you may have one, some, all, right? So it doesn't tell the teacher where to help support. If you get a report which says, I have challenges with spelling and I need to have reread information again and again, the teacher now knows how to support that individual. So understanding the traits is much more useful than the label, right? So if I say I have ADHD, two people will be very different. So I might be able to hyper-focus on the things I'm really interested in. I might have developed strategies to really good coping strategies, but I burn out, right? Somebody else might be completely different. So the label itself doesn't help you support the individual.
So on that, I mean, by that token, when you realised about your own neurodiversity, did you seek a diagnosis, or are you content to say, I have these traits?
I haven't. I mean, I'm chair of the ADHD Foundation. I live and breathe ADHD. I read everything about it, right? I don't think I'm stupid. I'm sure I've got ADHD, right? But I don't need a formal diagnosis. Who will I go and have a conversation? Then somebody says, yes, you do, you know. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Do I need it? No, not really. Should I take some medication? I've thought about it. I have thought about it because I think it might help busy brain, sleep, focus stuff. You know, it might be helpful even at my stage of my life. So I have thought and thinking about it, whether it's worth doing that.
I mean, it doesn't help you sleep.
No. It doesn't help you sleep anyway.
No, but and it does wear off before you go to sleep anyway, but it has been, and I'm speaking from experience because I am medicated from it, it has been very helpful, academically specifically, but obviously if that's not something that you're currently struggling with.
I'm currently trying to write another book and I'm finding that struggle, really.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, I know, so that might be helpful, wouldn't it? It might get me to the end of it, really.
Mm. I mean, I think it's really interesting. It sort of chimes a little bit with my clinical kind of approach, and you're absolutely right. When we think about diagnoses, most of what you do you can do without a formal diagnosis. You can do once you're in that kind of ballpark, and I sort of, you know, slightly contentiously, I sometimes wonder why we fixate so much, for instance, on the autism diagnosis, which once you've got everything in place that the child actually needs for their everyday difficulties, what does a diagnosis add? It adds, as you say, a ticket that they can then trade in for a support elsewhere in the system. But that's a circular argument. It's important because it's important. There's nothing inherent to the diagnosis itself that seems to me to be at all important.
And I think it's the bad enough principle. And I think for parents seeking diagnosis for their kids, having to present the bad enough principle, which is, you know, you have to say all the things your child can't do to get the diagnosis. And the concern is that if they get better, or they doing better, or are better, or just better in the first place, we don't celebrate that. We go, okay, let's take away the services and support that we've given you now because you're doing okay.
Yeah.
So our system doesn't sort of promote how do, and also still now 25-30 years on, we're still working in professional silos. So, you know,
Yeah.
So you go off and have a diagnosis of autism, you go off and have a diagnosis of ADHD, of dyspraxia, you know, in different places, even though we know they all overlap and our brains don't know about it. Just people box us and it doesn't help in school because it doesn't say I've got challenges writing and at speed and my writing's really untidy and I find it hard to focus in the class that I'm not interested in and I make spelling mistakes. If you fit not into a neat box, you don't get anything. Well, that's exactly crazy.
And yeah, that's very frustrating for families.
Yeah, hugely.
And I think, I mean, it must be so frustrating to have watched that process. You know, I think over, you know, more than two decades ago, you kind of had, you've been breaking the mold, but the mold is still very much in place. And it drives me absolutely crazy. I've been trying to kind of chip away at it locally, but it's incredibly difficult. And a slightly technical question, but how, I mean, do you have an insight as how we change that silo working? Because it is, particularly in the current state of the financing of the NHS, it is an incredibly inefficient way of working, as well as being not family centred and leading to all sorts of kind of leading to all sorts of, I think, cognitive bias and less than ideal diagnostic practice.
I've got lots of ideas. I think the first one is that we have a problem because government works in short time spans. So so that's a problem. Health and education, social services all operate separately. That's a problem. And where budget aligns, that's a problem. So unless we can shift that thinking, we can't get long-term change because governments will only want to achieve things that they can do and impact very quickly. Where it works well, I've seen locally, we've been working on it's called Together for Children and Young People, where we've got people coming together. I think neurodiversity is an opportunity because it's the first time I've seen in medical journals, in education places, all talking about neurodiversity rather than in the past we've talked about developmental disorders and specific learning difficulties.
Yeah.
So that's hope. I am hopeful. I'm an optimist even after this time that we can change training people. So awareness that this stuff all overlaps and people are people. And we need to have those same conversations in health, education, social services and justice. And education seems to be a focal point where we need to start because every child goes to school and parents are there. It's where there's an intersection.
Yes.
And it's where we can have the most impact, really. But we've got to get health professionals to be in schools rather than remotely. So we need to be sited more in the community, closer to families, and utilise what we've got and use parents. We don't run out of them. They're the most enthusiastic group, you know. So why not train and support parents to support their kids better?
Yeah, and actually the other thing about schools is that they're not trapped in this kind of diagnostic paradigm, which I'm not saying we shouldn't throw out entirely, but they do have this kind of needs-based approach just by training and design. So they are natural allies for this kind of approach, really. Although there are problems in the way that they are funded and regulated by government, it often acts against a diversity and kind of SEN agenda, but on an individual basis, teachers get it, I feel.
But I just think, you know, you're going to be doing exams now. You've got exams coming up. And I just think that we often do exams which are an end point, right, rather than you go all through, get to GCSEs or get to your exams, and then it's like the big stuff. We need to change the way we attribute all the things you're learning and you're doing all the way along. You know, I'm sure you've got skills in lots of areas that school doesn't even notice or recognize, perhaps. I think maybe we'll be better at that. I was reading something about Khan Academy, the guy who set up, do you know Khan Academy?
No,
have a look. So he set up Khan Academy and it's free online teaching and learning, amazing. And he's got millions and millions of people on his platform. And I think that where we need to go is doing things like digital credentialing. So this is recognising the skills and talents that young people have as they move along. So the fact that, you know, you can successfully make a cake, we need to recognise that because that's a useful...
You can successfully make a cake.
Not really.
Very good, Kate.
No, not really.
Or something else. Or something else, okay.
Not tidily make a cake, successfully no, make a cake.
The cake's like falling over, and like I put the icing on before the cake was fully cooled, so now it's melting.
Yeah, it's delicious. Your cakes are delicious. They are messy, though.
I do that.
When I try and get it out of the tin, it falls apart.
But I think it goes back to just trying to recognise the things that people can do. Do you know what I mean? And not squeeze people into an educational model which says it's all got to be down to an exam at a set time. You know, and the pass or fail thing of that, I think education could really deconstruct and reconstruct and change the way that we recognise people's skills in a way that we're preparing everyone for the next steps, really, in a much more effective way. And I think education could be a hub, and health can work with that.
Yeah. That process. Yeah.
If what's our outcome? You know, why are we preparing? Why are you going to school? Why are you going to school?
Why are you going to school?
I feel like I don't think I think it's necessary so that I can have a job and live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're gaining skills.
Yeah. No, I'm gaining grades so that I can gain more grades, so that I can get a little piece of paper, so that I can write the fact that I have that piece of paper down on a slightly bigger piece of paper.
Okay.
Send that into future employers and go, look, I'm good enough. And
I've got a piece of paper.
Maybe you are good enough. And then they'll let me in and I'll be underpaid for the rest of my life.
Yay!
Yay! So that's why you're going to school. Yeah, I do think we could be doing that a little bit better. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci was the first person who did CVs. I think we need to change some of our way we're doing some of this stuff. You know, I think we can recognise skills in lots of different ways. So I think,
yes, the slightly bigger piece of paper is a lovely image. Just sort of gradations of bits of paper until you finally end up with a piece of paper big enough to get a job. You just measure your bit of paper when you go into the interview. Well, it's a lovely image.
It is, but it's as random as that now.
Yeah, exactly.
The employment route is really random. You've got to know the rules, right? Yeah. You've got to be able to fit into those rules. And if you don't understand them or know them, the people who do so much better, which goes back to the beginning of this, which is I didn't know what the rules were and I had to keep learning what the rules were in each situation I've gone into to try to be to fit in with those rules.
Yeah.
I mean, the piece of paper thing is very literal for my experience specifically because I go to a grammar school. Ooh, fancy posh. which meant that I had to take an exam, which was my 11 plus, so that I can now do better in my exams, which are my GCSEs, so that I can get back into my school so I can do my A levels, so that I can go to university, so that I can graduate. And all this kind of stuff is just a cycle of doing shit because people tell you to.
Well, measuring it, well, what is it measuring, I think? That's the thing, you know? It's measuring your ability to sit an exam.
It is, yeah.
You know, I'm not sure it's measuring. You know, and the people who do well at it, like this woman, this girl in class who I used to hate because she always used to do much better than me, she was good at exams. She knew those rules, you know? She could perform in that situation really well. So we favour people who can fit the paper. I love it. I'm going to do a picture of that. You'll see it later. I will reference you, I promise you, okay? The little bit of paper with the big bit of paper.
There you go.
Good analogy. Test,
baby.
Hooray.
Shall we do the fourth question? Because I think we've kind of gone a little bit back to your past, Amanda. I've got a bonus sixth question. So,
okay.
So, don't forget that.
So, looking back, is there anything you wish had been different?
I wish I'd understood myself. I wish I could look back and be me now. I'm not obviously 60 at 16 because that would look really weird. But I wish I could have acknowledged that it's okay to be different and recognise that and lived with that discomfort and felt comfortable with it, if that makes sense. Allowing myself to be quirky and accept that and embrace that would have been much nicer than having spent years and years having to try to fit into other people's narratives. So,
and I think you said something just now, which just sort of offhand, but it sort of feels important that it's not being comfortable, it's being comfortable with your discomfort. So I think sometimes we kind of aim for everyone completely accepting you and being your best friend and, you know, thinking your neurodiversity is wonderful. And I wonder if that's realistic, and perhaps it's more realistic to say, I'm not going to be in the big groups because that's just humans. Humans are just always going to be humans, and they're always going to aggregate into people who are the same, and neurotypicals are always going to neurotypical. And being a slight outsider is not something that you're ever going to change, but it's getting okay with that.
And finding other outsiders.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's allowing me to, I'll still camouflage. I think it's recognizing that sometimes I will, because that's life, and I have to go into situations that where I will have to fit in, right? But actually now I can go, I know I'm doing this, which is a very different thing from not realizing I was doing it.
Yes.
So I'm giving myself permission to camouflage, as opposed to having to camouflage. So that, you know, so going into a situation where I'm meeting people, I don't know them. I know that I can hear myself, you know, with a narrative, and that's what I said. And I think that's okay. So I've given myself permission to, and also to go, I don't have to go there if I don't want to either. But there's life, which says sometimes you have to go to places you don't want to go.
Right? Yeah.
So you've got to be realistic. And sometimes you're going to get things wrong, and sometimes it's going to be uncomfortable. But recognizing that's okay, not beating yourself up about it.
Yeah.
I think that's the difference. I don't think neurodiversity is all glossy and shiny.
No.
And everybody's having a wonderful time. I don't like that narrative that everybody's a superstar. And I don't think that's the real narrative. I really don't. I think people's lives are complex and messy, and you'll have good times and bad times.
Well, I would agree. And I think sort of ADHD is my superpower, and, you know, my amazing autism. I think it's okay for very young children who are feeling terrible about themselves. But once you get beyond, you know, kind of very young ages, you need to have a more nuanced understanding. You need to have a more, you know, the struggle is real, you know.
Yeah. Although I think it is important to bear in mind that some of the positive aspects, because otherwise you could just get lost into this like pool of negativity. And, well,
just to amplify for listeners what you said, Amanda, earlier about the bad enough principle, because it might have taken people a little while to say that that's not someone's surname. So you have to, you know, in order to get a diagnosis, to get help, you need to be bad enough, you need to have enough, and that's a trap that you have to kind of, as professionals, emphasize the negatives about this person so much that actually sometimes you end up exacerbating those negatives and making everyone feel so bad.
And if someone's been focusing on those negatives, because, like, you know, if you want a diagnosis, you'll be like, oh, okay, I need to keep an eye on everything that's going on so that I know what to say to the person. Then you've been spending this extended period of time focusing on your problems, your issues, what makes your life more difficult. And then you're pinning it all on this one problem, and it's just going to make you feel awful.
I agree.
All the interruptions.
The room for the people who are all impulsive and all
that's fine. You go first, Amanda.
I've lost it now as well.
Look at that pearl that we've thrown away. And I suppose one of my real worries is that if you focus so much on all of the things that are wrong with you, and here's this golden ticket, and everything is going to be okay once you get the golden ticket, and it's not. And I think as doctors, we hold out sometimes, partly to make ourselves feel important, the idea that these diagnoses are life-changing, or that can be, but only if they're put in a proper context.
And if something happens as a consequence, you know, I use the term spiky profile, so that people have spiky profiles. So we have strengths and we have challenges. So understanding me is about understanding my overall spiky profile, right?
Yeah.
Recognizing that I've got skills in some areas which are, you know, that I want to use, and that's great, but I've also got challenges. And I think that's a more honest conversation to talk about your spiky profile, rather than going, you've got this label, this means this, because it's still you, it's in the context of you know. And I think sometimes we give the ticket and we forget the context.
Absolutely.
Well done. You've got the diagnosis of. Off you go now. Next.
But the service is designed to just give you the ticket and off you go. I mean, the only thing that NHS England, for instance, is interested in the neurodevelopmental conditions is how many autism diagnoses we hand out. They don't care whether we put people into context explicitly. They're not interested.
But they're inaccurate. You know, first of all, well, the data's inaccurate. So that's for another day. Because autism is on a spectrum and it co-occurs with everything else. So it's not even accurate, the data we've got.
No, I know. I always think about, well, what if the person who I'm criticizing is listening? I don't think they, you know what I mean? I'm not saying that the head of ASDLD in the NHS England is listening, but if you are, hello, Sue. It's not her fault.
No, it's not. It's not. It's a systematic challenge we've got where we're shoehorning people into certain diagnoses, but there is a diagnostic bias going on. So, yeah. You know, you get more. There was a great study done a couple of years ago showing that if you had speech and language problems, and you had higher speech and language problems and you didn't have a diagnosis of autism, you got less than if you had autism and lower speech and language problems. Okay, so the diagnosis of autism got you more speech and language.
Yeah, which doesn't make sense.
I think a lot of people, this is related to something you said earlier, sorry, I've just taken away from that a little bit. But I think a lot of people, when they start to think that they might be neurodivergent, they get a diagnosis for the sake of getting a diagnosis because they don't feel like their problems are valid unless they've been verified.
Mm, okay.
And then I think a lot of people, once they get that diagnosis, just feel a little bit lost.
Yeah.
Or they don't really know what they've got the diagnosis for.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's very important to bear in mind what you want.
Mm.
I think you probably need to do some research into what's going to help you. And if a diagnosis isn't a necessary step to get there, it's not a necessary step to get there.
Yeah,
and it's a lot of bother and a lot of emotional, you know,
cost,
turmoil for you. And it's not even going to be that helpful.
I know.
I think you're absolutely right that sometimes we hold it up as you need to have it, because unless you've got it, we don't acknowledge you properly, right?
Mm.
Or you haven't got you can't sort of say, can I say I've got ADHD unless somebody else has told me I've got ADHD? You know, should I be saying that? Should I be actually saying I've got ADHD because somebody else hasn't told me? Or is that valid, truly valid?
Yeah.
You know, and I think you're right. I think people often think it's going to be, everything's going to change the day after, but you're still the same person the day after as you were the day before.
Mm.
And I think you're right. There's an expectation something will change. Perhaps.
But there isn't a straightforward answer because my answer to should there be someone external to yourself who checks on your understanding and validates your understanding of yourself and you know, kind of diagnoses you and kind of clarifies your profile.
Mm.
I think the answer to that is probably yes. There probably does need to be someone who's not you.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was actually thinking about me at that point as opposed to one. So do I need somebody else to validate that I have personally got ADHD or not? Maybe, right?
Yeah.
I do diagnose ADHD in others.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But you're right. I think people, sometimes I'm hearing, so you've got on Twitter and, you know, different social media channels, TikTok, you've got people standing up and going, this is me, this is me. And it's a bit like, you know, looking up in the sky. If you look, you'll find the colour that you're looking for in the sky because it sounds a bit like me, you know. So, and I think you need to have somebody saying, yes, but it's that differential diagnosis. It's saying, yes, but did you remember you did have a head injury? That could be.
Yeah.
So I think we do need, I'm not getting rid of doctors because other professionals, we do need them. But it goes back to that circle of you can't get help unless you get a label. So we need a different approach to that, which says you can have help with your practical things you're finding difficult. So if you've got difficulty with planning, have help with planning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, let's filter down.
Yeah. I think it's very difficult because ADHD is actually quite complex as a disorder, and there's going to be people who don't fully understand ADHD who just hear attention deficit hyperactive disorder and they go, I do those things.
Yeah.
I'm ADHD. Mm. And that's not always the case. Those problems could be sourced from other things, like just stress. Especially if you're a teenager, it could just be stress. And obviously I'm not trying to invalidate anyone's issues. If your stress is causing you this kind of problems, it is a problem, but it just might not be ADHD.
It might not be ADHD, yeah.
And
no, I think I agree.
It could create a little bit more stigma around it, and it can create the idea that everyone with ADHD doesn't really have it. And it's really complicated and there's no easy answer
to it.
What were you going to say?
No, I think I agree. No, I was just agreeing with you, which is I think that if somebody's got challenges, they've got challenges and they need some help and support, what we've got to make sure is that everybody gets the most appropriate help and support.
Mm.
And I think that I'm concerned with sort of that sort of random self-diagnosis is not, and coming up to the wrong conclusions and trying to do it on your own when actually there's help and support out there that could help with your challenges as well. And
yeah.
So I think it's the pathways into that, and I do think they're inequitable. So the pathways to gain a diagnosis are not fair, right? They're predominantly white and middle class, and those who are vocal, those who shout loudest get. And it goes back to the prison, you know, which is the people who wandered around and been excluded from education, excluded from society, don't get the help and support that they require, even though they've got the same set of symptoms and signs.
No, absolutely. And we have to be so careful about the inequalities within this space, because they really do exist. And I mean, some recent stuff about how Black children, for instance, are treated in a more kind of coercive way within school. Mm-hmm. You apply that to the ADHD kids, you know, you can absolutely see how it happens. I know. I work in Lambeth, and, you know, more than half of the school population are BME.
Mm-hmm.
You do see the different ways in which, even in populations that really, you know, populations of professionals who really kind of understand these kids better, there is still a difference in the way that they're treated.
And again, it's not a biological disposition, it's how you're raised, it's how you're treated,
and yeah,
it's what kind of ideologies your, like, society has put onto you because of the way that you were born.
Yeah.
And the way that you...
I think there's also sort of intergenerational stuff. It's like, if I look back and I know I can map my family now and go, oh, look, he had ADHD. I'm sure he did, you know.
Yeah.
But I think you've got families who have not been made aware or had an opportunity. And so, you know, they may have been severely somebody who can't read, write and spell, that just says, well, that's like us in our family, you know. So yeah. Unless you have support and awareness of people around you to say, well, actually, do you know what, though? I think this is a challenge for you, but there's things you can do to help.
Mm.
Unless we give people those opportunities to have those conversations, they will miss out on learning about themselves and reflecting back and going, oh, yeah, Grandpa so-and-so was like that and Auntie so-and-so was like that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. We're lucky, aren't we, that we're in that fortunate position to be able to do that in a way.
Very fortunate. Shall we ask the fifth question?
Sure. So what are your hopes for the future? This could be more personal or on a more like on a global scale or something like that.
Personal, retire. No. Have a holiday. I think my hopes for the future are probably the same as they were 25 years ago, in a sense that I haven't given up, which is I want equitable routes into support. I want practical guidance for people that can be reached in a way that is meaningful and accessible and understandable. I want the people who've got spiky profiles to recognise their differences and embrace and be able to celebrate them. And for my personally, I want my grandchild to be able to show his talents in a way that, you know, showcase his, so he can be the most successful person he wants to be in the way he wants to be. That will be wonderful, that they can do, and they don't have to fit in to a system. The system can fit them.
Yeah, absolutely. So our bonus sixth question, because your pinned tweet, which only went up 11 hours ago, was what are the three adjectives that describe your strength? So I'm going to turn that upon you. What are your three adjectives, Professor Amanda Kirby?
persistent, passionate about what I believe in. That's more than three words, but I'm going to just take it.
Well, it's your tweet, so you can do what you like.
That is, exactly. and thinking outside the box, which isn't one word either.
No, but it should be. There should be a word for thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
Quite possibly the Germans have one. So let's say that the Germans have one.
There's probably like oddball. A synonym of creativity, something like that.
Oddball.
Oddballity.
Right.
Oddballity. That's my third.
There we go. Oddballity.
I'm sure there's a word.
Tess is going to come up with one. Anyway, we'll post it on our Twitter or whatever.
Great.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amanda Kirby. People can find you. I mean, you seem there's a lot of wonderful stuff you put up on Twitter, and I've just literally closed your Twitter, so I can't remember your tag.
At Prof Amanda Kirby, P-R-O-F Amanda Kirby. And then LinkedIn, I'm on there, and I do a newsletter every week.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
I should subscribe to your newsletter. I did not realize you did
that. That's with lots of references, research, links to lots of things. And so I can link back to your podcast as well.
Ah, very nice. Good. Wonderful.
Do some free advertising for us. Okay.
Yeah. We're not that good at it, are we?
No. I don't think we're very marketable to the youths of today.
Oh, I think you are
youth of today.
You are.
I'm a slightly strange youth of today.
Yeah, but there are lots of slightly strange youths of today.
And that's our audience.
That's the audience.
There we go. I will create a TikTok page for extraordinary brains.
Yeah, you should. I am not going to do that because I'm too old for TikTok.
And so am I.
Yes.
Yay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today,
it's been
Amanda.
Lovely to have you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Can I just say, I'm still feeling tired.
Just check in. Tess is still tired. All right.
And so am I.
Much.
Goodbye.
Okay. Well, that was Amanda. Tess has become distracted by playing with the dog. So it falls to me to say, please do share the episode. Hello. So what, Tessie? What are our social media tags?
I don't know.
Extra Bones Pod.
Extra Mitosis creates two identical daughter cells.
Tess has basically gone full biology GCSE. So Extra Brains Pod is the tag on various social media. ExtraordinaryBrainsPod.com is our website. Our dog is going a bit mental. And goodbye.
Okay, message us if you have any questions.
Bye-bye.
Bye.